Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi there. Good to see y'all. Very nice to be here. I've been away for a little bit up in the mountains, which was very good. It's good to spend time in the mountains, I think. But it's wonderful to be back here. This place is very beautiful. I go to the mountains and I think, ooh, everyone drove here all the way across the country to be in this beautiful place, including me. And then I come back home and I think, oh, it's beautiful here too. We have a wonderful place to live. So I wrote this talk that's called Radical Responsibility. And I thought to myself, now that's a cool title. Pretty self-congratulatory. And then I was pretty happy with it. And then I looked at this flyer for this workshop I'd been thinking about going to for about a month and a half. Which, for those of you not looking at me, can see is titled Radical Responsibility. And I had a little chuckle. I'm hoping to have the opportunity to practice at this workshop in October with Bleet Mall, who is a former longtime federal prisoner and a activist, peacemaker. He does trainings in how to help people who are in prison develop mindfulness practice, and also this one is more oriented towards people in leadership positions developing radical responsibility. I don't know what he's going to say about it, but I develop my own ideas. But it was kind of funny because, you know, you think that there is an idea in your mind that you made. It's never true. Certainly in this case, that was really clearly highlighted by finding out that my original title had been floating around in my mind for quite some time. So, and one of the reasons I want to give this talk, Radical Responsibility, has to do with a question that I hear a lot, but I heard yet again last Sunday at Intro to Zazen, which is, I was talking about, you know, to study the ways, to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And someone was like, yeah, but if you're doing all this living in the moment and, you know, observing the self, how are you, you know, I got a job and how can I actually go out and do anything? So hopefully this talk to some degree addresses that question of how what appears to be an introspective practice is actually a practice of altruism. So radical responsibility, I could say responsibility, maybe half the people saw the title and they said, I don't want any responsibility, and they left. But I mean, you might say radical opportunity or radical empowerment would be another way to say this, but radical responsibility has a little bit more ring to it because the alliteration, of course. So I might say this moment of choice is the way. Radical meaning at the root. So at the root of where your responsibility lies is the topic of this question or this talk. So radical meaning various things, but in this case mostly like the root or the basis. So you might say, why is this practice of sitting around and doing Buddhism, why is this helping people? And the simple way to answer that, I should just go with the simple answers first, is there's several hundred well-documented studies and a long cultural history supporting the idea that meditation helps people to be happy, it helps them to be generous, and it helps them to be not anxious. And I believe, maybe this is just an article of faith, I think if there are more people who are happier, less anxious and more generous, the world is going to be a better place. Was that? That's pretty simple. There probably are some people who say what we really need is more competition and aggression. So in this degree, we are working with faith. I think that the world will work better if people are happier, less anxious, and more generous. So I'm a sucker, I guess. So this radical responsibility that is suggested at the basis of what Buddhism is that taking care of our own heart and mind will allow us to realize that we're not separate from other things, so that when we take care of this moment of responsibility, we're taking care of the world because we realize there's no separation between us and the world. But we'll kind of get there through the course of the talk. So first, I'd just like to talk about... Hello, come on in. It was like the first, what they call the first turning of the wheel sutra, or the Buddha's first discourse. He teaches the Eightfold Path. He says, this is what I'm recommending. The reason I recommend it is because it's conducive to well-being or non-suffering. This is what I'm going to talk about for the rest of my life, basically. Keeps coming back to it. The Eightfold Path being right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Right, all is good at this point to mention that right is a translation of a word that does not mean right at all. Samyak, the original Pali word, means basically complete or whole. So holistic intention or holistic speech might be a more accurate translation, but just sounds a little clunky. So if you look at the Eightfold Path, which is basically... the teaching that Buddha keeps coming back to is the method that he recommends. He's like, this is what I'm doing and what I'm recommending. You can do what you want. You came to me. You know, people come to him and ask for help. He says, I'll tell you about this. Everything in the Eightfold Path is exclusively about your own choice. There's nothing in it about things external to yourself. Nothing. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Now, some of these specifically, like right mindfulness, if you begin to delve into the teaching of right mindfulness, there's a lot of emphasis on actually looking at the emotional contents of your experience within the self. So that is like clearly introspective. But you might say, wait a minute, right action, that's about doing stuff. But it's about your action. It's not about the results. So, in simple terms, 12-step people are really smart. They managed to make this much simpler than me. They say, I'm responsible for the effort, not the outcome. I'm responsible for the effort, not the outcome. Right action is not about controlling the results of things external to yourself. It's about taking your moment of responsibility here. Your radical responsibility at the root of experience and stepping into it. And we could say this is radical opportunity. Often it doesn't feel that way. I would like to take the opportunity to lie on the couch and look at websites rather than step into something really conducive to well-being sometimes. But we could also say this is radical relief. Because if you, like me, look at the contents of your mind on a regular basis, you'll see a huge amount of the time this mind is worrying about things that are like completely out of my control. You know what I mean? Just churning over and over on like, here's a good one. Did you ever have an argument? I won't just put that with a period. Let's say, did you ever have an argument or an interaction with someone that produced a really strong tendency over maybe the course of the next day, or maybe, in some cases, the course of many, many years, where you go back in your mind and you re-argue this point? And you're like having a really good argument because your opponent is kind of debilitated because they don't exist. They don't even exist, so you get to win. So here, what's happening is no responsibility for what's happening in the self. No responsibility. I'm just saying this is all about this external object, which is a complete fabrication. It's not happening. And just getting completely absorbed in this fabrication. That's just one example. If you look at mind, I think you'll see this happening all the time in gross and subtle forms. So, conversely, what can one do? So, for example, in a situation where I say, see this tendency like, oh, I cannot believe she said that. We already had this other agreement, right? So my mind starts to manifest, and it's like, ooh, this could get really good. We could have an hour of processing this. And what happens is, if one is fortunate and has been doing this meditation practice and committing to the Eightfold Path, is we realize that we are in pain. That it is suffering that causes us to want to make this story. And if, as Buddha recommends, you start with mindfulness of body, and then once you have become aware of your body and become intimate with it through practice, you start to become aware of your emotions and your thoughts, you realize, oh, right now there's like, I'm really tense. You know what I mean? I'm really tense and I'm either pacing or maybe I'm completely immobilized because I'm somatically manifesting all this energy that I didn't even know I was doing because I was like, just retreating way up into the mind. So we can start to be aware of just the body and the emotions, and we can take this radical responsibility for taking care of the suffering that's here. We're not going to take care of the suffering that's here by arguing with ourselves or with a person who doesn't exist. We can take care of suffering by taking care of the pain within us that makes us want to go there. So, this is the kind of teaching that makes people begin to think that Buddhism is about navel-gazing and is like, you know, you're going to be like, I don't care about you guys, I'm just over here taking care of my suffering. However, if you're walking around a lot of the time thinking in these long arguments with people who don't exist about things that happened long ago, your capacity to be helpful to other people, in case it's not obvious, is diminished. So, we have this opportunity, radical opportunity. Maybe I'll change the title in the middle, sounds more fun. And it's about empowerment, right? Because instead of being powerless in the face of this tendency to rehash this argument or this issue or this thing that's come up again and again, we have the capacity to say, I'm going to step into the moment and take care of what's here with an open heart. Do the basic practice, which is Buddhism, which is the alleviation of suffering and the promotion of well-being. I can do it right now with the thing that is most vivid, apparent, and needing it, me. And, you know, it doesn't take long in a lot of cases for that to just aerate the issue, and then the story goes away. There you are. You can meet somebody. On the other hand, maybe the power of that story is so intense that it'll just run right over your practice. That's what we call karma. Karma is powerful. So karma means a lot of things. And is understood really variously throughout Indian literature. But in simplest terms, it's you know, the cause and effect that creates the cycle of life. And generally speaking, in Buddhism, pessimistic sounding, but the cycle of suffering. On the other hand, that's not pessimistic, because the whole point is you don't have to do it. There is a path of liberation from karma and suffering. But I won't go deep into this at all, complex issues. But basically, principal innovation of Buddhism, a couple points on karma. One, Buddha, at least according to the Pali Canon texts we have, says karma is intention. As one intends, one does actions of body, speech, and mind. So, pretty famous quote. So he's saying, karma is intention. Karma creates suffering or non-suffering. So karma is basically, in simplest terms, it's like, if you're angry, you're more likely to be angry later. Right? It's just the body and the mind have habits. But we can analyze this with science now. People who are angry tend to be angry because they reinforce the patterns in the body and mind that create anger. So, now, he says this is about intention, and this is pretty important, because he also says in another sutra that karma is not, and this is what is less known and really important, not the cause of all suffering. In fact, all kinds of things cause suffering. Karma does not cause tsunamis. Karma does not cause you to be blind when you're born. Karma does not cause you to have a stomach ache. Now, he says that, but there's a caveat, because it's like, yes, your intentions and the way you live can affect whether you have a stomach ache. They affect whether you choose to live on the beach, which if a tsunami comes is why you make some problems for you. Right? So it's not like they're completely separate. But this is not a system whereby it's like the universe is made of like some kind of system of karmic retribution. This is really a psychological model of understanding, seeing how we're patterned by our intentions. And why does this matter? Because Buddha is so relentless in the simplicity of his message, which is take care of this moment of your intention. Right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort. This radical responsibility. Because you can't control whether you'll be happy tomorrow. You can't even control whether you'll be happy right now, which he specifically states in another sutra. What you can do is you can say, oh, wait, I want my life to be about alleviating suffering and promoting well-being. And then go, how can I do that? What action of body, speech, and mind can I do that will promote this intention? And that intention and those resulting actions of body, speech, and mind, karma actually meaning action by definition, repattern consciousness. So, we don't have to do the same stuff over and over again. We don't have to carry all the really problematic stuff that came through our families to us, to all of us, to some of us perhaps more so than others, and through our cultures, and through our own selfish behavior, our own unconscious tendencies. So karma is really about the possibility of liberation in this school of thought. Now, it's also important to remember that karma also shows that everything in your intention is patterned by previous intentions and conditions. So that means, this is where it gets kind of confusing, that means actually your intention in this moment is not something that you're choosing. It's just something dependently created by the universe. Just like everything else. That's a basic teaching of Buddhism. Like everything is just the universe coming together in this moment like it is. Wow! We can't control that. So I think what I just said is pretty sure I just said this whole thing is about just stepping into your opportunity, your empowerment, your responsibility of this moment of intention and realizing that that is actually arising from conditions beyond you that you can't understand. So it's a very popular debate in Western philosophy. Is there free will or not? It's actually a really hot topic right now because the brain scientists, are, a lot of them are like, oh no, we can show that there's no free will. Buddha has a good answer. Is there free will or not? Yes! So, yes. You might think, it sounds like mind games. If you realize that your moment of intention arises because of conditions that are beyond understanding, you can have compassion for yourself because your intention will not be good a lot of the time. That's to be human. That's the value of the view of interdependence. Compassion. Seeing that there's something beyond all of us that causes this moment to arise. On the other hand, having a sense of free will is fundamental because if we don't have it, who cares? I'll just do whatever I want. Screw y'all. Not helpful. All these teachings aren't meant to be metaphysical or something. They're just meant to be helpful. None of it's... I'm not talking about the truth. I don't know anything about the truth. I'm just talking about a tradition of saying things that hopefully promote human welfare. You know, you can cultivate intention. It's pretty basic. I think we're all going to do it, or most of us will choose to do it. At the end of this talk, we do our little vows. You know, it's really nice. We chant the Bodhisattva vows. It's all about cultivating and saying together the intention to devote ourselves to the well-being of the world. And this is actually powerful. So just actually consciously coming back to the intention over and over again. Every time I meditate, I say something to myself about my intention, or if we're doing it here, we often have some kind of chant. So I can really recommend that. And actually, throughout the day, I do this. I'm just like, what am I trying to do with my life here? Am I just trying to, like, get through? As I was talking to someone about it, he's like, we're taught to trivialize our lives. Taught to trivialize. Ah, that's good enough. Whatever. I got a good sandwich. Pretty good day. Your life can be more than that. Radical empowerment. You can step up and say, my life is about the alleviation of suffering, and you could just keep coming back. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? What does that do to your heart to say that? I can do various things. So I will talk a little bit about... I'm going to come back to that, I think, actually. Let's see. So... Now, the thing is, if, like I said, if you just decide, like, now I'm going to have the intention to liberate beings all the time, one, it's not going to work, and two, you're going to get depressed. Because you're just not going to do that. Because we all have too much karma that's saying, like, I need a new iPod. You know what I mean? And we got, like, all this evidence coming at us to promote our selfishness, our self-centeredness, our old patterns of mind, our patterns of anger, our patterns of depression, our patterns of anxiety. It's powerful. It's powerful. We got to live with that, and we can't just suddenly decide right now, I'm done. So we have to make the decision moment to moment. But, like Stoicism, which is an old Greek philosophy, basically says, just do it. It's like the Nike model of intention. They're missing something. Buddhism wisely says, if you're going to do this, you really need to look at how your mind works and be kind to that. So start in here and begin to understand and be present to the way you are, and that will actually kind of liberate and make room for this intention to wake up and get really big. So that's why, among other things, it's one of the reasons that meditation practice is so heavily emphasized in the tradition. And in early Buddhism, much more so than what we do around here, you know, you just get a list of things that might arise in your mind, like distraction, anger, desire. And you sit and you watch them come up, right? Now, we don't usually use the list model, but we are encouraged to be aware of what's happening emotionally in our consciousness and in our bodies. And it sort of naturally happens. If you draw your mind to your breath and there's some space between your thoughts, you're just going to start to notice how you feel. And that's helpful. The idea isn't to, like, control how you feel. You know, if we could control how we feel, wouldn't we all already be doing it? You know what I mean? Like, sweet, I'm going to be happy now. So it's to be aware, present, connected. So this is, like, about radical responsibility. Responsibility for your own attention to what's here. Taking responsibility for yourself and realizing that most of the time when you're thinking about how someone else is wrong, what's mostly happening is you're angry and you're projecting. That's what it is. I'm angry and I'm projecting. So we can take responsibility. This is me. This is my terrain. This is my heart. This has been really transformative in a lot of relationships for me. I have some pretty angry people in my life. And, you know, I can now meet them without, like, the same anger, just a nice mirror. Let's all just be angry together. I can meet these people just like, oh, I understand that when you're angry, I suffer. I pay attention to that, and I can see that you're suffering. And that's the way it is. And I'm here with you. So... You know, Dogen, the other Buddha, Dogen says to study the way is to study the self. And to study the self is to forget the self. So his model isn't very psychological. Probably more recommending just if you look, you go, what is the self? If you keep asking that question, your sense of separation from things begins to dissolve. But it does, you know, in the context of Buddhism in general, a lot of Buddhism is about just investigating who I am right now, really on a psychological level. Not like a complicated story-making psychological level, like, I feel this way because my mom did this, which is actually a valuable practice. but more just the psychological level of what's happening within this body and mind. What's happening in the body? What's happening in my emotions? What's happening in my cognitions? Interesting. Who am I? What is this? So, this meditation, part of the path, it's about taking responsibility for who we are in the moment, in a certain regard. We also have in the Eightfold Path what's usually called the ethical side, so right speech, right action, right livelihood. And, you know, this is really good. So this just puts the emphasis on what you're choosing to do rather than what you're making happen. So I can say, like, I like to work like door knock for political candidates. I think it's fun. It feels good to me. I feel like it's helpful. I mean, someone's got to do it. I mean, that's how these things get done. So I just go do it. And, you know, I usually go out on election day and I work at night. So, like, I knock on, like, 400 doors and I talk to 7 people. And oftentimes, I'm not exaggerating because I live over there, like, more than half the people are either hiding because they're clearly illegal aliens or they're felons and they can't vote. So I knock on door after door, no one answers, and then people are like, they like see them running in the back of the house speaking Spanish, or like everyone comes, I'm a felon, which by the way is ridiculous. I won't even go into that. Did you know that like 1.5 or 2 million African American men cannot vote because they have felonies on their records? I'm not going to pursue that in life again. See? Radical responsibility. Come back in. I can feel it here. Oh, the pain I feel when I think about that. In here. So I do this, and, you know, I just do it. It's pretty cool. I feel good about it. But I remember one time a friend of mine did a lot of work for Kerry. A lot of work. And then he didn't win. And she was just like, I can't remember how she put it. She said, it didn't matter. It didn't matter. She only saw the outcome. Right? She only saw the outcome. Or like if you write a poem, you'd be like, well, this poem didn't get published and touch 1,000 people. You're only seeing the outcome. Someone has to write poetry. There's no Shakespeare if a bunch of people don't write poetry. It's not like we can have one poet and he happens to be the one everyone reads. People have to make the effort, and we don't know what the outcome is going to be. So we can be really beautiful about how we do this. I heard a person being interviewed on the radio who is a doctor who... She developed a program. She treats a lot of gunshot victims in Philadelphia, usually young African-American men. And she developed a program whereby they bring in at-risk youth to the hospital, into the emergency room, and they talk about what it's like to get shot. And it does seem to be causing people to not want to shoot people or get shot. There's not a lot of data, but that's the impression they get. But at one point during this thing, the interviewer asked her, you know, what do you, you know, you've got someone lying on the table and you're trying to save their life doing this operation. Do you think about, like, whether they were, like, a perpetrator or a victim? And she said, no. No. Right? There's just suffering. What can you do? Her capacity is to save lives in this situation, so she just does it. She doesn't have to figure out whether who's right or who's wrong. She just manifests compassion in that moment. And this is the kind of attitude that enables one to actually keep working for the universal good without burning out. Right? If you're thinking about all the time about the results, you're going to fry. There's too much suffering. We're not going to get it done. We're all going to die in a world with huge amounts of suffering. I'm sorry to say it, but we know it's true. But we all have the radical responsibility to step into our own moment of effort and just realize, what can I do right now that would be helpful? I heard Naomi Tutu give a talk at Martin Luther King Day a little while ago. It was awesome. Naomi Tutu is Desmond Tutu's daughter. And she told this story about, I think it was Martin Luther King's brother-in-law was driving him between events, but I'm not sure if it was his brother-in-law. But anyway, apparently the brother-in-law related this story sometime after Martin Luther King's death, which was that they're driving and it was late at night and they're really tired because they're just like working furiously. And people kept coming over these hills with their brights on, and he was like getting really annoyed, and so he'd flip on his brights and just be like, "Turn your brights off, man! Turn your brights." Sometimes they would, sometimes they wouldn't, and he'd just drive right past them, everyone with their brights on. I don't know how much time you spent driving on two-lane roads in the country. With everyone's brights on, it's pretty dangerous. That would be one way to put it. And he did this a couple times, and then Dr. King said, "You should really just turn your brights off." He said, "Someone's got to be able to see." Someone's got to be able to see. It's about your choice, not someone else's. So to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. Good old Dogen Zenji, such a wonderful companion on this path. So he teaches us this, and you know, if you pay attention, you sort of draw the attention to the self, and we don't know. The first thing that happens, you go, "Oh, wait a minute, what is the self? I don't know." But we say, if I'm looking more at myself, I'm probably looking more at my body, the way I feel, my thoughts as thoughts, not as some kind of truth that is happening, but just as thoughts that are rising in my consciousness. And if you do this, your attachment to the truth of the ideas and the patterns you have will start to soften. And if we do it with this intention we keep coming back to, of the alleviation of suffering, we can be really kind to ourselves in that process, so we can soften to that. That conditions the mind karmically to meet whatever it meets with compassion. If the mind learns to meet things with compassion, it's good at meeting things with compassion. But if we don't take care of all the stuff churning inside here, sometimes we'll be trying to be compassionate, but we're actually just like... you know, what's codependence basically means when you try and control other people and take care of them and make them okay because you're anxious? What it boils down to. So, you want to come in and take care of this anxiety, because I can guarantee you codependence does not work out really well in the long run. So, there's just this softening. Sometimes there's this complete shedding in that process of all the conceptions about the self. It does happen. Maybe there's no self. There's just something happening. Samadhi. So there's this softening or porousness of the self that happens through practice. Sometimes there's complete seeing through. But this is why... we begin to have the capacity to really be available without getting fried. And we begin to be available in a way that isn't about, like, thinking we can control someone else so that we can feel okay. So we say, old saying is, You don't say you have compassion for your hand when you pull it out of a fire. So when you realize that everything is just part of this vast connection, then, and you have cultivated this tendency to be not swept away by emotion and governed by the intention to alleviate suffering, then you just naturally, seems to me, you just naturally do things that are helpful, that are kind. And you don't have to see whether the other person is suffering or not, or is separate or not. I was talking to a friend of mine who was really upset the other day, really unhappy, suffering. And, you know, sometimes in that situation in my life, I've been like, oh, man, wow, I want to get home, right? Really? Are you worried about that? Right? Oh, let me explain to you why you shouldn't be unhappy. Because really, right, oh, here's what you should do. So, you know, I got all kinds of defenses that my consciousness is patterned to create, but none of them came up. And it was like, well, because I've done a lot of this practice, I didn't have to feel terrible, right? If I feel terrible because my friend feels terrible, then I'm busy. That's when I want to try and control everything so I don't have to feel bad. I was just like, oh, I know what suffering looks like, and we're not really separate. There's something happening here in this moment that includes suffering. Where does my heart go? Where does my attention go? To the suffering. I didn't do much, frankly. I'm not very helpful. But I was there. Hopefully that was enough for my friend. I don't know. I like the way one of my favorite fellows is Hongzhi. I just can't help but quote this passage because it's really cool. Because it really talks about this progression of attending to the habits of consciousness, letting them dissolve, and then being available. So I hope I can. Yeah. You must purify, cure, grind down, and brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. You must purify, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. Then you can reside in the clear circle of brightness. Utter emptiness has no image. Upright independence, responsibility, does not rely on anything. Just expand and illuminate the original truth, unconcerned by external conditions. The deep source, transparent down to the bottom, can radiantly shine and can respond unencumbered to each speck of dust without becoming its partner. Complete intimacy without getting caught. Wow. Sounds pretty good. Let's do that. Will you guys do that with me? I hope so. Buddha, in a very early sutra, says, in this very one fathom long body, along with perceptions and thoughts, 1 fathom, 6 feet. Well, some of it, 5'9", come on. Okay, in this very one fathom long body, along with perceptions and thoughts, do I proclaim the world, the origin of the world, the end of the world, and the path leading to the end of the world. So when he's saying the world here, he means the world of suffering. He says, in this body, is where you do it. And the reason he says the whole world is there is because there's not actually a separation. There's not actually a separation, and yet it's in your body that the opportunity to do this exists. In this body, in this moment, through your action, body, speech, and mind. So like I say, we could say, ooh, responsibility sounds kind of scary. So let's say radical relief. Because the thing is, think of all the things, if you really deepen your relationship to this teaching, that you don't have to be worried about. right? The future, the past, we can take a little time to work with them, but we don't have to be caught by them all the time. We can just see in this moment, oh, what can I do? What can I do in this moment? Make coffee. I will make coffee. That's a good choice. I will do it with my whole heart. I will meet a friend and just see them completely. I will meet my own suffering when something happens that I don't like completely. Just now. You don't have to get good at it. You don't have to wait to do it. This moment, this very moment of choice is the way. Well, I think that concludes my remarks. I thank you for listening, for your wholehearted attention, which is actually what this whole thing is about, not about me talking. So I invite questions, comments, or any other expressions of who you are. Go ahead.
I'm just going to make a comment. I saw this a long time ago, a Dharma talk by this guy. He's very famous. I can't think of his name, but he does brush calligraphy on huge canvases. And he's also a peace activist and author and travels around the world lecturing. And he was talking during his talk about how much he liked cooking and gardening. And somebody asked him, how do you have time to do all these things and cook and garden? And he said, really never forget this, and it's very inspirational to me. He said, when you spend your time only doing exactly what matters, you'll surprise yourself how much time you spend. That was really cool.
I want to share a story. I was just out in the mountains as well, and we were working in Idaho, and I started getting nervous because I thought I had not done my job, and I was with an undergraduate field assistant. And she was asking all these questions, and I was so worried about my own shit that I just didn't see it. And finally, after, you know, I sat, and I actually tried to meditate after a little hard, but finally one day, she just kept asking all these questions, and I said, are you concerned that you will not get your thesis done? I got out of there, and she went, yes. I said, okay. So I had to get out of my own head so
that I could see
what was going on with her. And now, if I could do that all the time.
Wonderful.
Question. When you're in the presence of someone else's suffering, and you're aware of their unhappiness, whether they're expressing it or not, it sometimes feels as though just being there isn't enough, but then you have to somehow take on or experience or at least kind of mirror their facial expressions or their suffering. And if you don't, they feel, and I've had this experience where they feel like you're not there.
Mm-hmm.
You're not really with them. And so I'm wondering if I was clear in that description.
No, I get it, yeah.
And how you approach that.
I think that's a good point. I mean, probably I approach it pretty intuitively, personally. But it's not the case that, like, if someone is, like really, you know, someone is standing there crying, like, I'm going to be like, ah, yes. You know? So, in a way, yeah. I mean, you want to meet the person, like, on a social, human level, right? And that's good. And if it's painful, that's not too bad. You know what I mean? Like, that you're actually moving close. I mean, so we really can't expect to always just be like, oh, I can be in the face of huge amounts of pain and not feel it. Right? I mean, usually if that's the case, to tell the truth, we're probably resisting it, right? So there's probably some hiding. So actually, just moving close, you know, Pema Chodron also talks about just moving closer in, I think is good. And then it's just good to pay attention, like, you know, to whether then you're going to try and control the situation to deal with your pain, or whether you know you're going to get burned out You know, because that's, you know, sometimes you need to take a break. Oh, I can't take it on. But yeah, it's not. When I talked about this experience of not having a lot of emotion myself, it's just like that's just what happened. It wasn't like I was doing something. You know, it's just that didn't come up. So I felt in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra, Buddha says, see suffering internally or externally. So see it in yourself or see it in someone else. Either one is good, right? So just be close. I don't know if that's a helpful answer, but...
It is. It's an uncomfortable situation.
Yes, it is.
And so it's hard to not want to do something. I think that's kind of what I'm always aware of, is like the desire to... Maybe not understanding yet that it's a desire to alleviate for myself the suffering I'm witness to, mm-hmm. to try to kind of cut it off. But if I do something, I can busy myself.
Mm-hmm.
And not have to just be in the presence of the wave, you know, it's like the waves of it, and you're just letting yourself take it, and if there's a little bit of a fear that, can I take it?
Mm-hmm.
Can I take it? Can I handle it? And so maybe a follow-up question now, is, do you believe that through meditation you develop a capacity for that, taking it or just receiving it and not letting it kind of just sink in and fill up, so that you then have no more.
I do, absolutely, absolutely, and mostly it's because if you can be aware, I think, of the way your own emotions are working. If you just see them, that is actually really powerful. It's just like when you're suffering, you want someone you love to see you. You're giving that to yourself. That transforms the suffering, and that conditions the consciousness to be able to meet all suffering in that way, I think. Now, doing something is also can be really good. You know what I mean? Like, give someone a hug. That's good. Or, you know, knock on doors. Whatever it is. So this isn't about passiveness. But it's about trying not to be sort of reflexive about our response, I think.
I have many of those in a couple of situations. I work over the phone now. So unfortunately, there's that phone connection, so I'm not physically with people, but I have to work helping people manage stress. So I struggled really hard in the beginning of that job because I took on everyone's like emotion all day long, and I didn't have a good way to handle it without taking on all the emotional energy. So I found being able to, it's kind of like teaching mindfulness, I guess. When I'm feeling like I'm getting overwhelmed and my chest is starting to tighten, I'll just reflect that. And I'm like, wow, just hearing that, like I'm getting anxious, my blood pressure's going up. You know, so I just talk about my physical signs, and then they feel like I get it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's all I do, but, you know, it alleviates some because they can tell I feel it. I don't want to do about it.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
I'd like to tell you that joy that happened yesterday. I love being around children because I think that they're just so pure, and sometimes I see like the path they're going down to create the habits of taking it. We were up at the Greek festival, and there was a line dance of men, and I was with my 15-year-old daughter, and there was a man that jumped up and started to dance, and he couldn't dance, and he wasn't dancing like everyone, and he was making incredible himself. He was having a really good time doing it, and my 15-year-old took him on. She was sitting quite a distance from him, but she became extremely embarrassed for him, and her hand went up to her face. She turned bright red. She was so embarrassed she couldn't even watch him dance. And she turned to me and she had tears in her eyes and she said, I have to quit taking on these emotions.
Whoa!
And I thought, yeah. You really do. So she was channeling this. For him, his pain and suffering.
Wow.
Then he didn't know he was having.
Wow. Yeah, well, I think the practice is recommended in this tradition there is to see that we do take them on and then become attentive as our own, right? So it's like, yeah, don't try and push emotions away, but as they come in here, attend to them. That enables us to be present to them in a way that's not quite so problematic. That's an amazing realization by a 15-year-old, though. Whoa! That's awesome.
You talked about angry people in your life, and for you, what is right action for you in the face of an angry person that triggers anger in you?
Well, it probably depends on the degree and the relationship and a lot of things, but
it's an intimate relationship.
Yeah, generally speaking, optimally, the first thing I do is notice my own reaction, and I'm attentive to it, which is, you know, I do have some pretty angry people in my life. So, and sort of say, well, here's what I can take care of best right now. Because otherwise, you know, I'll just reflexively start to, you know, judge and, well. So, and then, you know, for me, the people that are angry in my life, it is the case that it's best to just disengage with them completely. Just what seems over the course of the years to have been the best thing. But yes, yeah, generally disengaging. But this is, you know, particular relationships. Yeah, I just say sometimes I don't even say I'm not going to talk to you until we can have a civil conversation. But sometimes I do. You know, like if you're going to, like, say insults to me, if you want to talk to me, we can do that, but I won't do it in that way because it's unhealthy. So, but that's just one thing. There's no, you know, ultimate answer, I don't think. But if I think a good way to start is just to focus on taking care of your part, your own heart, your own actions. And you'll just see your mind over and over wanting to try and control them or explain them or something. And that's not very helpful. You know, it isn't. So I hope that's a helpful answer. It's kind of terse, but...
He's related to that. I'm just focusing. Now, according to the Enneagram, I don't know if you're familiar with it, okay. And number one, okay. And by being number one, my negative side is ira in Spanish. Anger. How do you say ira in English?
Ida?
Ira.
Oh, Ida, ire, yeah.
That's my main thing. And now, my main things come in when I relate to somebody else. It is not because of them, it's because of me, and in brackets, I'm asking for help to let me see in another way that I'm seeing now. And then, but this degenerates and becomes personal. And then, for me, solution and problem is not always is what, but normally people take it and make it to who. When you do that switch in the air, you automatically becomes two injured people, very injured, and no solution.
Mm-hmm.
And then, when my eye comes out, he says, okay, we got a problem here. And I would like the input. And I get the reaction, a personal reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't know what to do in these cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, like I say, individual cases are hard. But I'll come back to just the basis of this teaching. Like, if you want input and you're not getting it, how does it make you feel? Right? So you want to say, but I really want the input. And instead it's like, I can't get it. So it's just, we keep coming back to the heart.
Yes, I come from Argentina. And a boxer was in the ring. I always make some points from jokes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and there were two boxers and one was receiving. He says, take off your left, your right. Take up your twice. That's what's going on in this. When you see that so many punches come towards you, it's not place for do that. And then you attend somebody else, and because the answer should be in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens if you are running and you say help, and say no, you help yourself.
Well, it's good to get support. Everyone needs support. Yeah.
I was in South Africa for many years, and one guy there was in Japan. He was working for a motor company, and he was amazed. And for me, this became very strong figure in my life. Is safety workers, and then one checking the other how he is dressed, and the other check. And in this world, because we are so limited in life, but we cannot. And then we need the extra time. It's not that you are not going to tell me how to dress. I know this. I know this. No, it doesn't matter. I check on you. You check on me. When you need adjustment, I help you, and I help. In the moment that you help others, you are helping yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But when you jump into the things, don't tell me what to do.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's you have a good point. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we do. It's true. We must. Oh, it's good. Thank you.